Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well and enjoying your weekend. I'm super excited to dive into your questions. Before we get started, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalists Live. Is the conference that I have coming up at the end of June. They're going to be incredible speakers there, probably 12, 13. We've got maybe 7 or 8 of them booked. Just booked Doug Casey, the living legend himself, Chris Martinson, Mark Moss, Kenny McElroy, Lynette Zhang, among others. So go to Rebel Capitalists Live right now. Check it out. Get your tickets, because as we get closer to the event, the prices increase slightly. So if you get them now, you'll save a little bit of money. All right, let's get into your questions, guys. Let's see what we got. How do you recommend minimizing counterparty risk with your gold, silver, other than storing it? Yeah, I was just going to say holding it in your back pocket. you just got to do some research and work with people you trust. For me, I trust Sprott because I know Rick pretty well, and I know he retired, but as well as I know Rick, I just cannot imagine that he would be working with a company that wasn't extremely reputable and did things the right way. So Sprott, number one, as far as, you know, where to hold your gold, again, it's just research. And then depending on how much you have, I would go there myself and tour the facility, wherever you're thinking about storing your precious metals. It's in Singapore. I'd go to Singapore. Singapore is very nice. I've spent a lot of time in Singapore in my life, and I mean, months and months and months and months. And it's a great place to go. I mean, if you're just storing, I mean, it all depends on how your risk tolerance. For me, if I had 100, 200, 300,000 in gold or silver, well, probably gold, silver, that might be, I'm not sure the space that would take up, but but with gold, it wouldn't take up that much space. I wouldn't have a problem just throwing that in my closet or something, but I know I'm most people aren't like that, but maybe you build a safe in your house or something. I think that's always best. Might suggest looking at a watch. I know I say that and people kind of think I'm crazy, but not like this. You don't, this watch is just, don't buy this, because this is the type of watch that'll lose value. What you want to get, if I could go in my closet there, you get a good Rolex in the box with the papers, and that's going to maintain its value, or maintain its purchasing power, let's say. Value, I think that's not the right way of saying it. That gets a little confusing for people. It's going to maintain its purchasing power, and that's that's what you want with gold, and that's what you get with that, with a Rolex, and it's a little less cumbersome. So anyway, that's kind of what I do. I just carry it in the back pocket. I do the boots on the ground research, or go with Sprott. You inspired us to venture to dangerous Medellin. Yeah, dangerous. Yeah, I'm in dangerous Medellin right now. And boy, oh boy, I was out at the golf course all day yesterday. There's people playing tennis around me. The kids' pool. Just it's just like any type of really nice high-end country club that you have in the United States, the mountains in the background and kind of the buildings, the sun, I mean, the weather, the birds. There were scarlet macaws when I was playing golf on the front nine. There were a couple scarlet macaws that flew by. If you guys don't know what those are the giant parrots. You know, people call them parrot. They're actually called a macaw, I think is their correct name. And it's incredible the quality of life here. So yeah, dangerous, a little sarcastically. We're exploring a plan B option for part-time residents and Airbnb. We are staying in Poblado. If us, would you consider purchase or wait for correction? Well, correction, I'm not sure what you're referring to, because the real estate here has gone up, that's for sure, but it's really gone up with the rate of inflation. If you go back to 2000, I remember I did this one time, I went back to 2000, and even though you've had significant price inflation over the past 4 or 5 years, going back to 2000, it's pretty much, it's gone up at like something like 12% since 2000 in real terms, not per year. That's since 2000. So it's just, you've had some high degrees of inflation, which kind of you expect in a South American country. So I definitely wouldn't wait for a correction here, but, I don't know, but I wouldn't come in and buy right away either, because that's, you're just asking for problems. You've got to come down here, spend some time, do your exploring, figure out. I mean, you might not like Poblado. You might like Laureles better. You might, you know, think, oh, Poblado, it's nice, but there's too many hills. That's what a lot of the gringos, or they, a lot of the gringos come here and say, oh, Poblado's okay, but it's there's too many gringos. I want the real Colombian experience. So they prefer to go to Laureles or Envigado or something like that. Or some people like the mountains and like to go up to Rio Negro. So you got to come check it out and you know, meet with contractors, meet with Angie and Joaquin if you want. They're the husband and wife team that I use. And once you do that for 4 or 5 months and figure out prices, understand the comps, understand the neighborhoods. I mean, people say that real estate is different, like street by street, but that is definitely true here in Colombia to an extreme. So you got to know these streets. You got to do all this stuff before I would even consider pulling the trigger and buying. And again, I can almost guarantee you're going to love Medellin, but you, after being here 6 months, you may decide that buying isn't right, or you may decide that you want to live in one of a suburb that is a little different than Poblado. You might want to live up on the hill in Tesoro. You never know. So I wouldn't try to overanalyze it right now before you get here, because most likely your mind's going to change. That's the way it always works, isn't it? So just come down, enjoy the weather, enjoy the food, enjoy the people, enjoy the scarlet macaws, and just kind of take it all in and do as much boots on the ground research as you can. And at the end of the 6 months, then go ahead and make a decision. If the Fed continues to raise rates and the national debt over $30 trillion, what happens if the U.S. government can't afford interest? Well, why could they not afford it? Are they going to run out of money? Nope. Nope. Now, the interest rate may go way, way up because the lenders might say, hell no, I'm not lending money to the government when they're spending like a drunken sailor. And therefore, I see the future inflation expectations getting higher and higher and higher. Therefore, the interest rate that I'm demanding to buy this 10-year treasury is going to go up and up and up. But you got to keep in mind that, in fact, I should probably do a whiteboard video on this. If you looked at a pie chart of the buyers in the treasury market, keep in mind, it's much different buyers at the long end and the short end. And people assume that the only reason why someone would buy a treasury is just to get the yield. It's just you're buying a treasury, you're buying a bond. So the only value in buying that bond is just the coupon or the interest rate you're being paid. And therefore, it's a pretty easy equation. If you're getting 2.5% on a bond and inflation expectations for 10 years are 7.5%, then you don't want to buy that bond. Or if inflation expectations over the next, you know, amortized over the next, or averaged over the next 10 years, let's say you're a deflationist and you think it's going to be 2%, well, then it might be a good deal to go ahead and buy. This is a massive oversimplification to the point of being wildly incorrect, especially at the front end of the curve. Very few parties, if you're looking at a pie chart, you know, the majority of the buyers there at the front end are going to be institutions, big financial institutions and large pools of money that could care less about the interest rate. That's the least of their concern. They're just buying those T-bills for balance sheet management. They're just buying it for dry powder. They're just buying it as a cash equivalent to make a couple basis points. They're buying it to rehypothecate it. They're doing all these things that most people don't even know exist. And, you know, they might be doing that at the long end to a certain degree as well, or there might be a majority of people at the long end that buy them because they have to. Maybe they have to have cash. I mean, think about this. If you're a money manager and you've got $10 billion, and you, let's say there's certain rules for the fund that you manage. And let's say one of the rules is you have to be, let's just say 10% in cash or cash equivalent, okay? Are you going to keep that in cash where you're getting 0% interest, or are you going to keep that in a treasury where you're getting 2.5%? you say, well, George, it's crazy because of Treasury, you're losing 7% to inflation because real rates are negative, or 7% or whatever it is, you know, 5% or 6%. Yeah, I get that, but that's not your choice. Your choice isn't Treasuries or this or this or this or this or this. Your choice is simply Treasuries or cash. So quite frankly, I still would take the cash because I would want the optionality. I wouldn't want to have to sell my liquidity or my dry powder at a huge loss if interest rates went up and I had to sell before maturity. Therefore, you're going to take a haircut. Or you could be a large institution that thinks that we're going, you see the yield curve invert, and you say, shoot, we're going to have a depression or a slowdown. We're going to have disinflation and maybe even deflation, especially in asset prices. Therefore, I think that the Fed's going to come into lower rates. It's going to drop the whole curve, and I'm going to make a capital gain on this bond. You see, so there's a lot of different reasons. But anyway, I'm way off track here, aren't I? The main point is that the government isn't going to run out of money. They're just going to pay a much, much, much higher interest rate, but there's still going to be a buyer there. And at the end of the day, the Fed might just go ahead and buy. That's probably what most likely is, that the Fed becomes the main buyer of the supply of treasuries issued by the government. And the Fed can't run out of money. You got to remember what in their terms, not in our terms, because we look at the correct definition of money, or let's just say currency, dollars, right? How are dollars created? If you're just looking at it the way it works with the government spending it and the Fed monetizing it, excluding the commercial banking system, understanding that the commercial banking system is the main way in normal times that quote unquote money is created, dollars are created. But just looking at it through the Fed and the Treasury, if those were the only two entities involved, it's just typing digits into your computer. Like, I'm sure all of you are at your computer right now. So, it's like saying, how would you run out of, if you had a calculator, like a Google calculator, how would you run out of numbers? You can't run out of numbers. It's just because you're just typing them in your screen. So if they can't run out of numbers, then they can't not afford to make their payments, no matter what the interest rate is. The question is, although they're paying it in nominal terms, obviously they're not paying it in real terms. So they're not paying back the purchasing power that they had promised. So that's what they cannot do. And therefore, they're stealing from the average Joe and Jane. They're stealing purchasing power from them. They're basically, it's an indirect tax, really. So, but anyway, my main point there is that government can't, they can't run out of money. Therefore, they can still afford the payment. It's just at what interest rate can they issue debt? And then they can always have the Fed come in there and monetize it. It's really, I think the better way to look at it would be, what will happen? I'm kind of rephrasing your question. What will happen if the government can't make interest payments without exacerbating consumer price inflation? I think that's the way you got to look at it. How does reverse repo affect Fed's ability to apply QT? It doesn't. I mean, all quantitative tightening is, I mean, you got two options there for quantitative tightening, reducing the balance sheet. You just don't roll over the debt. So let's think about this. If you've got let's say the Fed has one 10-year treasury and it's maturing tomorrow. It matures tomorrow. So what are their options? They get paid back from the government. So the government has to do what? The government has to, most likely, the TGA could have some money in it, but then they're going to have to borrow more money to pay something else. So just assuming that they're kind of hand to mouth at the TGA, which is the Treasury General account. If you're asking about reverse repo, I'm sure you know what the TGA is. And so the government, Janet Yellen, Treasury, would have to issue another treasury to pay back the Fed, because their treasury matures tomorrow. So there's still, if the Fed allows that treasury to roll over, or does not allow the treasury to roll over, they take payment, then what would happen is Janet Yellen issues the treasury, then the private sector buys it, a bank or non-bank entity, then that treasury goes onto their balance sheet. So the treasury still exists. It just goes from the Fed's balance sheet to someone else's balance sheet, say at a different maturity or a different interest rate. And then that quote unquote money goes into the TGA, and then the Fed just deletes it. It's gone. So it could reduce the amount of money in reverse repo, amount of dollars in reverse repo, if the money market funds or their investors are taking that cash and buying treasuries with it. But it all depends on what they do. There's really not a direct link between QT and reverse repo. There's just maybe a direct link between QT and the balance sheets of potentially the commercial banking system and the non-banking entities. So Fed would have, after they allow that to roll off their balance sheet, they would have one less treasury, one less bank reserve, because the treasury would be the asset, bank reserve would be the liability of the commercial bank. If it was purchased by a commercial bank, they would have they would do an asset swap, a new treasury for the bank reserves that the Fed had as a liability. Non-bank entity, then you would have, they would give the liability of a commercial bank, that would disappear. Then they would get the treasury. And then let's see, how would that work on the, then that would also, let's see, if they get that, then that would go from the commercial bank down into the treasury. Then the treasury would go ahead and pay the Fed with that. So that would decrease the bank reserves. Yeah. So this gets very complex, as you can see me go through it. But the bottom line here, I don't want to really go over this too extensively without the whiteboard. But the bottom line is, it doesn't really affect it directly. It just could mean that the cash that's in reverse repo right now would prefer to not be in reverse repo and buy treasuries with it. Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist Show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today. As a U.S. citizen, would you dare to pull several hundred thousands out in cash out of a bank? I'm worried about the deep state pulling. Yeah. So one time I bought a house, back when I was an entrepreneur, I was extremely naive as to how these things worked. And I just didn't have a clue, really. I was shockingly naive. And I right about the time, in fact, when I retired in 2012, I started buying real estate, as most of you guys know. And I had about, I don't know what it was, a couple hundred grand in a safe deposit box in B of A in Kansas City. And so I was buying a house. And I just wanted to use the cash that was in my, or some of the cash that was in my safe deposit box. So I had to get like a cashier's check for 100 grand or something. And so I went into the box. I just grabbed 100 grand. And then I went up to the cashier gal, you know, whatever they're called. And I said, yeah, here's 100 grand. You know, I need a money order, or I need a cashier's check or whatever. And the gal almost fainted. I mean, the bank manager like sprinted over. It was like something out of a movie, like I was robbing the bank or something. And, you know, the security guy goes over, locks the front door. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, what is going on here? And oh, it was just a complete nightmare. I mean, it was just an ordeal for like a half hour of questioning and paperwork and this. I'm like, isn't this a bank? Like, it's $100,000 just for a cashier's check. I mean, don't you guys do this all the time? Like, it was just complete panic, freak out mode. To your point, like almost black SUV mode. And then I got a letter from them, I don't know, a few days later, saying that I needed they were going to close my accounts, and I had like 28 hours or 24 hours or 48 hours, something like that, to get all of my belongings out of the safe deposit box, or I wasn't getting it back. And so my point is, I don't know that you'd have the black SUV show up, but again, this was back in 2012. So maybe you would today. I don't know, but I doubt you would. But my point is, the bank would freak out. Now, if you've got a good personal relationship with them, then it's probably going to be a different story. Then what I would do is I would call the bank well in advance and say, hey, I need, you know, a couple hundred grand in cash. You know, I don't, you know, 2 weeks, I want to give you guys plenty of lead time here. What's the best approach? What's the best plan of attack? And then just keep in mind that if it's a Wells Fargo or any of these basically banks that are controlled by the U.S. government, there's a good chance they'll shut down your account. So I would say 50-50. Even if they do it, they'll say, yeah, you'll get that letter in the mail. Now, if it's a community bank, like I've got two banks in the U.S., one is Wells Fargo and one is a small community bank in Kansas City, where I know the guy that's the VP of commercial lending very, very well. To the point, every time I go back to Kansas City, I always grab dinner with him or coffee or lunch or something. So if you got that type of relationship, then I really wouldn't worry about it. I don't know how, it still would probably take him a couple weeks to get a couple hundred grand, I'm guessing. And an audit, yeah. I mean, you're going to increase your chances of getting audited for sure. I would say there's if it's just a Wells Fargo or B of A, even if you get the money, there's probably a 50-50 chance they close your account. And there's probably, you probably increase your chances of being audited by the IRS by 10%, maybe. So actually maybe 100%, not that there's 100% chance you get audited, but whatever your chance of being audited now is for the average person, say it's 2-3%, then I would say if you do that, then it goes up to 4, 5, 6, you know, something like that. Do I agree with Michael Pinto that the Fed could actually continue to tighten while economy contracts, or will they let inflation continue so asset prices don't collapse before midterms? I don't know Michael's view on this, but I just think the Fed will raise rates until they break something. So most likely the stock market. How high can they? And then once they break the stock market, then how does it break? Does it go down by 20% in a week? If it's that kind of breaking, then they're going to reverse. Then they're going to go back to QT. They're going to drop rates. If it breaks simply by going down by 20% over 6 months, then I think they probably keep raising rates. So there's just a couple variables there, and you just got to determine what you think the probabilities are. And then at what point, you know, the front end of the curve is telling, or the 2 year is telling you that's around 2%. I did a whiteboard video on that the other day, maybe 2.5%. But I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it was lower. I would be surprised if it was significantly higher. So I would not be surprised if they break the stock market at 1.5% as an example. I would be extremely surprised if it took them to 3 or 3.5% to do it. We'll have to see how it plays out. Why not make money containing real gold, then price everything to milligram? Well, because then you're constraining the government from the ability to, because then the government could not. See, we got to go back to the question that I went way off on that tangent about with the government being able to afford, you know, certain types of payments. And if they cannot create, the Fed is limited if they're constrained, which they would be by gold. Now, the commercial banks wouldn't be necessarily constrained unless technically they would be if there was a 10% reserve requirement. But they've got so many ways around that nowadays, especially if they've got offshore banks that don't have any reserve requirement, the Eurodollar system. that's super easy for them to get around. Or they could just borrow the gold, you know, borrow the reserve, something like that. But now that's going to constrain the ability to do, you know, monetizing the debt and do the whole quantitative easing and whatnot. So that I don't see that as a high probability. How do the elites control the price of precious metals like gold? I don't know that they do. I've always been, I mean, if you think through how the market works with being able to take delivery, I guess there's some argument that in London, Luke talks about this all the time, but I can't remember the acronym there where they do all the trading in London. But long weekend, sorry guys. But there's definitely market manipulation, for sure. But I don't know that it really affects the price over the long run. I don't know if they could manipulate the price down for years on end. I think they could do it for a day or two, then it kind of goes back. And then, I've never seen kind of like a whiteboard video on how they could do that. I mean, I get that there's a lot more paper gold and they, you know, to buy a contract, you got to sell it short, but then they can, then they don't have to settle in gold. They could just settle in money. And I understand all that, but, I think if the price got too far out of whack, that they would just take physical delivery. And then if they broke the contracts, or if they delivered the money instead of the gold, then there'd be fewer counterparties involved there. I just think it would kind of work itself out. And as far as how the elites control the price of metals, I don't think they do. I don't think that anyone, not even the Fed, is bigger than the market. I know a lot of people would argue with me there. Especially the bond market, maybe on the front end, but like not the long end. I think the market is going to, at the end of the day, the market's going to be able to defeat any type of manipulation that an entity could pull off on the price over the short term. Do you think massive global bond defaults? No. Of held by China real estate, Peru, Pakistan, troubled countries could act to tighten. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, in the future, for sure. Yeah, because if you're defaulting on the USD debt, then you're reducing the balance sheet capacity for those banks in the euro dollar system that could provide the dollar liquidity in the future. So just easy way to describe it is if you've got, if you're a bank and you've got one loan on your balance sheet, or let's say two loans, and one of those loans defaults, you don't get paid back. Now, all of a sudden, you don't have that reduces your balance sheet, that reduces your ability to provide more dollar loans in the future. That's just really the bottom line. So, I mean, you can look at it in very simple terms. If you have $1,000 to lend out, you lend it out and the guy only pays you $500 back. Well, okay, that's reduced your balance sheet capacity to extend more dollar loans in the future. Now you can only extend $500. So it's, again, I hate to use that example because the euro dollar banks really don't deal with dollars like we think of them. They can make their own liabilities and their own assets, but without a whiteboard, it would reduce the balance sheet capacity. Therefore, that would trigger most likely more defaults with less dollar liquidity. And that means more demand for dollars outside of the United States relative to other currencies, which means the dollar goes up on the DXY or tightens the USD supply outside the US to your point. The question there is what's happening with the trade deficit? Because let's just take a huge, like an extreme example. Our trade deficit right now is like $100 billion a month. If it went up to, let's say, $1 trillion a month, would that make up for the defaults from Russia, Turkey, Peru, Pakistan, and in the sense that now there's you've got future dollar liquidity being destroyed by not paying those loans back, but you've got a lot of dollar liquidity sloshing around outside the United States because our trade deficit went from $100 billion to $1 trillion, or it went to $10 trillion, something like that. I know that's not realistic, but I'm just trying to take it to an extreme so you can get your head around it. So my point there, John, is there's cross currents. There's a lot of them. And it's not just, oh my gosh, the USD. See, the way most people think about this on either side is they would say, oh my gosh, the trade deficit is $100 billion a month. Therefore, the dollar has to lose value because there's $100 billion circulating in the global economy chasing goods and services. There's $100 billion more dollars every single month chasing goods and services. Or the other person would say, would ignore that. And then they'd say, oh, well, there's going to be all these defaults because of Evergrande and Chinese real estate market crashing. They're going to default on their USD loans. And that's going to reduce the dollar liquidity in the future. That means more loan defaults. That means less and less supply of dollars, dollar cash flow. Therefore, more demand for a limited amount of dollar liquidity. Therefore, dollar goes up on the DXY. See, it's like people get hyper-focused on one or the other. And they got to realize that those two things can happen simultaneously. And they are happening simultaneously all the time. It's not like there's never been a USD, like this year, do you really think that there's not going to be a USD dollar, a USD euro dollar loan that's not going to default? Of course, every year there's, I'm sure, USD default, USD euro dollar defaults, of course. And every year our trade deficit goes up or down or whatever. And so these things are happening constantly at the same time. So it's just getting your head around how each one works and then deciding which one is going to overwhelm or overpower the other cross current. But they're like those tectonic plates that Rickards talks about in with inflation and deflation there. It's the same thing with the USD strengthening against other currencies and weakening against other currencies. If the worst case scenario happens and nations dump the petrodollar, how do those dollars come back into the United States massively inflation? Well, I don't know if that's the worst case. It depends on what your objectives are, right? I mean, it's kind of like asking, is Russia winning the war? I don't know. It depends on what your objectives are. If your objective was to take over Ukraine in 3 days, then they're losing. If your objective was to dethrone create a catalyst that will gradually dethrone the dollar over the next 25 years, then maybe you're winning. And so same thing here. So if your objective is to bring manufacturing back to the United States, then this would be a best case scenario, not a worst case scenario. If your objective is to maintain the status quo and avoid a 2, 3, 4, 5 years of just massive economic pain, then you're right. This is the worst case scenario. But you notice you can't get, most people want all the manufacturing to come back to the United States, but they don't want any of the pain. They don't want any of the economic pain. And unfortunately, that's not going to happen. That can't happen. There's not a way to connect those dots, unfortunately. Again, it's like the heroin addict. You've got an economy that is addicted to monetary heroin. You can't just stop the monetary heroin and without a significant degree of withdrawals. And so we've got to go through some inflation. To get to the other side, I think that's actually, I mean, I hate to say it because it sounds crazy, but I think that's the best case scenario. If we could get a, well, I take that back, because you'd have to have that in combination with other things. You see, because this is another thing, and I oversimplify it. I make that mistake. It wouldn't be just the dollar going down to, let's say, 30 on the DXY. That would definitely help exports, and that would help facilitate bringing manufacturing back to the United States. But no matter how low your currency goes, no matter how much edge you have from an export standpoint, if you're overregulated, it doesn't matter. Like, look at Venezuela. Why are they not or Argentina? Why are they not an export powerhouse, right? Why is Argentina not Japan? Why is Argentina not Germany? They should be. They've devalued their currency. Because there's no, I know how South America works. The way it works is they just wake up every single morning and change the rules. I mean, there's certain countries that are worse than others. Ecuador is unbelievably bad. You never know what the rules are going to be just tomorrow. Who knows? Capital control, sure, done. No capital. Oh, yeah, no capital control. Oh, tax rates are 100%? Yeah, great. Sure. Oh, let's drop them down to 30. Yeah, sure. There's no way you could invest in that type of environment. There's no way you could build a factory in that type of environment. Where, think about that. You're taking $1 billion, let's say, and building a huge structure that you can't move, a permanent facility. You're hiring all those people. This takes years and years and years, and you've got to invest not only a ton of capital, but your time. You're going to do that in a country where the rules are changing just weekly? Absolutely not. Are you going to do that where the tax rates are 50, 60, 70%, you know, corporate tax rates? Absolutely not. Are you going to do that in a country that demonizes entrepreneurs, demonizes those greedy capitalists? No, you're not. Why would you do that? And no one's going to do that with $1 billion in 10 years of their life. Would you? You probably wouldn't even do that with $100,000 in a year of your life, let alone $1 billion in 10 years. So my point is, if we got the 1970s, let's say, to bring our debt to GDP down to more manageable levels, but we'd also have to reduce government spending. And right now, government is, 55% of GDP, government spending? I mean, how can you expect to have a booming economy or a sustainable, let's use that word, sustainable economic growth with government spending as 55% of GDP? I mean, think about that. That's bananas. So we need to go back to, yes, having the dollar at 30 or whatever would help. And that, you know, if we get that inflation, that's what we're talking about, the top of the question here. But we'd have to reduce government spending, and we would have to go back to where the private sector accounted for 90% of GDP. That's what we want. We need just constant, consistent rule of law that doesn't change. We need to go back to when I was growing up. And I mean, most of you on this live stream probably remember when you were a kid. We didn't demonize entrepreneurs. We didn't demonize rich people. Like, when did that? I know it's cyclical, and I know back in the 30s they did. And I get it, but you know, when we were growing up, we never did that. We never did that, and so we have to go back to the United States of the, I don't want to, you know, the 1980s or so, the 1990s. When rich people, or a lot of rich people that made their own money, of course, not people that stole it or just inherited it or something, or got it from government, being a government insider, or the Cantillon effect or something, but people who actually grew up poor and made a lot of money and became successful, we looked up to these people and said, that's what I want to be like when I grow up. You know, and nowadays, the only rich people that don't have targets on their back are just athletes in Hollywood, right? For some reason, if you're an entrepreneur and you make $10 million a year selling a good or service that you created because people value that good or service more than they value the money in the pocket, somehow that's the evil person, the evil capitalist. But yet, you know, Will Smith, that makes $100 million a year, you know, he's our hero for some reason. It's just, you get what I'm saying. We've got it. So it's not just, you know, being bailed out and having advantage of a cheaper currency. We've got to deregulate. We've got to go back to, you know, supporting these people that are the top 1% of producers that create all the jobs and create all the economic growth. And we'll create an environment where we actually can grow nominal GDP while increasing the share or the percentage produced by the private sector and decreasing the percentage by the public sector. But that's what we need to do. It's going to be difficult. Now, let me get to the latter part of your question, which I think is what you're really focused on here. How would those dollars come back to the U.S.? Okay, so let's assume we are China. So China produces a lot of stuff, but they don't have a lot of energy. So in the past, what would happen is China would send us their stuff that they produce, and we would send them our dollars. And then what would happen is they would take those dollars and they would send them right back to us, and they would get treasuries, And the government would take those dollars that they sent back and they would spend it. And that's one of the reasons why we got 55% government spending as a percentage of GDP. So it comes right back to the United States. Those dollars don't circulate in the global economy. They come, again, you've got to look at the dollar as two separate entities. You've got the domestic dollar and the international dollar. So when we run a trade deficit, that $100 billion goes to China. All of a sudden, it's international dollars. China takes those international dollars, trades them for treasuries, and those international dollars come right back to being domestic dollars. So the amount of dollars circulating, or the amount of international dollars circulating, there's no change. In the future, what happens, though, or what could happen, is we run that trade deficit, the $100 billion goes to China. Instead of buying treasuries, they say, we don't want these dollars and we have expenses, therefore, we want yuan. So then what they do is they take the dollars and instead of trading them for treasuries, they trade them for yuan. Now, all of a sudden, what has happened to the amount of dollars that are circulating, or the amount of international dollars circulating? Gone up, right? So now you get the dollar going down in value against other currencies. Okay, so now that you understand that process, let's assume that you're a billionaire and you have, let's just say you've got $1 billion in your checking account and you see this happening and you see the dollar going down in value consistently against your own currency and you're losing purchasing power with that dollar against stuff that you want to buy in the future. Whether it's oil, whether it's commodities, whether it's just a house in Colombia that's denominated in pesos and not dollars, something like that. And so what would you do? Well, you'd say, I need to get rid of this $1 billion ASAP. Okay, well, you're either going to take those dollars and exchange them for other currencies, which creates more dollars circulating, international dollars, or what you're going to do is you're going to say, I need to buy U.S. stocks or I need to buy U.S. real estate. I need to buy something in the United States. I need to buy a dollar-denominated asset that isn't going to lose its purchasing power, and I need to do it quickly. Then what you're doing is you're trading the international dollars on your balance sheet for a domestic asset, and you're transferring those international dollars back into domestic dollars to where they're circulating in the U.S. economy, actually chasing goods and services, because those dollars are going from international dollars on an international person's balance sheet to domestic dollars on a domestic American's balance sheet, assuming they're the seller of the dollar-denominated asset, right? Let's say you just bought a $1 billion building or something in New York City. And so the seller of that building, assuming they're U.S.-based, now they'd have U.S. dollars. So now the amount of dollars in the U.S. economy or M2 money supply would increase by the $1 billion. That's kind of the transfer mechanism there. So just in me going through that, you can see there's a lot of variables again, right? There's not just one thing going on there, because the guy that's got the $1 billion on his balance sheet, international dollars, does he really want a US-based asset? I don't know. Maybe he buys a US-based asset, but yet the owner is Chinese and therefore the dollars don't become domestic. They stay in the international market, circulate. Then what does that person do with them? You see, to sit here and like what most people do is they just say, oh my gosh, petrodollar going down, therefore, you know, hyperinflation in the United States. Maybe. It just depends, and each individual, you'd have to say on net balance, you know, what is going to happen more. I don't know that those especially if the dollars were losing value, I'm trying to think of another scenario which would bring dollars back into the United States other than to buy dollar assets. Well, I mean, if we got to a point where we were exporting more, if we were running a trade surplus, then that would bring dollars back. So that's another thing. If we got our act together and we started producing stuff here, reduced the regulations and everything I've talked about in this live stream, then all of a sudden we go, let's say, to a trade surplus to where we are now there's a reason other than just buying our assets for those dollars on net balance to come back into the United States. So that would be a way to kind of soften the blow here. You see, what it usually goes back to is we can sit here and talk about euro dollars and inflation and this and petrodollars and all these things. But in order for the U.S. to have a good outcome, it's pretty much self-explanatory. It's just going back to the basics, right? If we can just get back to the basics of reducing regulation, making it easier for entrepreneurs, not harder, capital is going to go where it's treated best. So we need to be a country that's just treating capital better than every other country. And it's that simple. I mean, it's not really rocket science. And then you go ahead and if we lose the reserve currency, okay, well, we're treating capital well, and we're going to get more manufacturing here. And if we don't lose the reserve currency, okay, well, then we've got that in our back pocket, but now we're doing more and more to get a higher percentage of GDP coming from the private sector. The problem with that, though, is either direction you go there, to get back on stable footing, it requires going through 2 or 3 years of significant pain, economic pain. And no one's willing to do that. The politicians aren't willing to do it. The people aren't willing to do it. Therefore, the problem just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. Or the amount of pain that you have to go through to get back to solid footing increases, and therefore reducing the probability of us doing what is necessary to get back to an economy that's built on a sound foundation. Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out-of-control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level. How many passports do I have? One. I'm in the process of getting one from Colombia. Got my investor visa, I think, right here in my bag. Yeah, I do. So this is what you get. I don't know. I think there's a couple different investor visas. I think because I had so much money here, I got like the top tier one or whatever. You'd have to ask Sebastian. He does all that stuff for me. But so I think if I hang on to this for another couple years, I can get a Colombian passport. I think, I mean, we'll have to see what the rules are then. And then I'll have two. I was thinking about buying one in the Caribbean because they got pretty cheap because of the cerveza sickness. But I think I'd probably hold off on, because if I'm going to buy one, I'd prefer to buy the Maltese citizenship, because although it's a lot more money, you know, you're going to put out maybe one, or it's going to cost you $1 million, bottom line, you know, maybe a little more, 1.2. But if I'm going to throw down $1.2 million on a passport, or actually even, you know, anything, if I'm going to throw $200,000 down on a passport, I'd rather throw $1.2 down on a passport that has visa-free travel to the U.S. So, you know, the St. Kitts and Nevis, the Antigua, the, I forgot some of the others, Grenada. What's the one that Henderson got? Henderson got one that I was looking into, and I can't recall the name of it. But, you know, it's just one of those Caribbean passports, but they don't have visa-free travel to the U.S. Now, some of them have a lot of visa-free travel, but not coming back here. So if I was going to buy one, it'd be Maltese. If I was going to do an investment, another investment one, I would do Turkey. Right now, it's like $250,000. You can buy real estate. You don't have to buy one of their kind of artificial projects, or one of these kind of, I don't want to call them scams, but kind of these, you know, these projects that are really just built to sell real estate to real estate or to passport buyers. And so I would prefer, like Turkey, you can buy any real estate. You can buy actually good, solid properties. And so that would be interesting. I'd like to have a couple more passports, but that's kind of the direction that I would go. I would go Malta for investment. I would go, I would go Malta to buy another passport. And then I would go Turkey to do another passport through investment. Do I think a bond sell-off will continue? Well, I mean, I'm assuming you're talking about the long end of the treasury curve. I think it'll, I don't have a strong conviction either way because the curve flattened. I think probably my base case would be that it'll continue to sell off if the Fed actually goes through with quantitative tightening. And once they stop, reverse course, once they break the market, then you go back to rates going down again. How far they go down, who knows? But I think that's kind of that would be my base case. It all depends on, you know, kind of what the Fed is doing and how the market is responding, and then how the Fed is responding to the market. So I think Florida would be a good housing market to buy at this point. I mean, it's high. It's extremely high. I don't like to buy things when they're expensive. I like to buy them when they're cheap. If I was buying in the United States, if we went back to that scenario, you can own one of two things, dollars or treasuries, which do you choose? If you said you have to buy a house in the United States, it would be Florida for sure. Florida or Texas, most likely Florida. Okay, guys, I think I'm going to leave it there because I've got to do a private live stream for the Rebel Capitalist Pro members. So if you're not part of Rebel Capitalist Pro, what on earth are you doing? What are you waiting for? It will take your investing to the next level at the very least. So you can check that out. That's the investment website I've got with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, Brent Johnson, Patrick Sresna, Tony Greer, Jason Hartman, all the best people on FinTwit. You can check it out at georgegammon.com/pro. And then check out rebelcapitalistlive.com for sure. Get your tickets. All right. Those are my pitches for the night. Let's do some shout outs. Who do we have here? We have Invisible Man. We've got Samantha Vial, Gregory Stewart, Bulldog, Alan Zibelman, Malaysia, Numismatic, RR, Wayne Smith, Scott D, Patrick Eek, Lee Pryor, Black Swan, C19, Crypto Beauty, James, Sustainable Lumber Company, my good buddy in the house. Hope you're well, my friend. Booze Bay, Cypherod, Michael Veloff, Volker Franz, Claudia Balskill, Boy Brow, John Dakota, All Nighter Hider in the house. I think you were on the live stream with, I think you were on with Martinson the other day, weren't you? Or you were on one live stream when I was being interviewed by someone else and they were doing a live stream and they said your name. I'm like, hey, yeah, there he is. I think it was on Chris Martinson's live stream the other day. Good to see you. Nestor Roldan, Luis, Roxanne Armstrong, Rigo, Chris Sauer, John Christian. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your evening. See you in the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.